Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying diplomatic row between the US and India following the arrest and strip search of India's Deputy Consul General in New York on fraud charges for paying her female housekeeper less than was stated on the work visa. Dr. Sumit Ganguly, the Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, joins us. He is just back from India, where condemnation of the USA has reached a fever pitch, with scant mention of the feudal conditions that the underpaid housekeeper has been kept in. Then we'll look into the apparent conflict of interest that the new owner of the Washington Post has as head of Amazon, who have a $600 million contract with the CIA. John Hanrahan, a former executive director of the Fund for Investigative Journalism, who was a reporter for the Washington Post and is the author of Government by Contract, joins us. We'll discuss Jeff Bezos's priorities and his newspaper's objectivity in covering the CIA when, as the sole owner of the Post that he bought for $250 million, his company has government contracts for cloud-based data storage worth a lot more. Then finally, we'll look into the real story behind the largest municipal bankruptcy in the nation's history and the role of Wall Street banks, who saddled Detroit with $1.6 billion in highly profitable complex loan deals that have extracted $300 million from Detroit with another $300 million to come, while public employees wait at the back of the line for eviscerated pensions that will now pay pennies on the dollar. Ross Isenbray, the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, who has an article at CNN, What Bled Detroit Dry? It's Not Pensions, joins us to discuss the winners and losers in the looting of Detroit and the city's unnecessary demise and liquidation imposed on it by a partisan Republican governor. And joining us now is Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, and India Since 1980, and his latest book, co-authored with Paul Kapoor, is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you.
And Sumit, you're just returning from India, so I imagine you've had an opportunity there to witness the reaction in India to the arrest and strip search of India's Deputy Consul General in New York on fraud charges for paying her female housekeeper less than was stated on the work visa. I take it criticism of the United States has reached a fever pitch.
It certainly has. The storm was already breaking just as I was about to board the flight to the United States. And there is a great deal of overheated rhetoric. And amidst all this rhetoric, what has been lost is the plight of the maid. Why was it in the first place that these charges were brought to bear against the Consul General? There's hardly any discussion of it, and all of it has been overshadowed by the rather inept and shabby manner in which she was arrested and subsequently incarcerated. Those things are indeed worthy of criticism, but they cannot be allowed to overshadow the fact that she knowingly and willingly, as far as we know, broke the law.
Well, it seems that she broke the law in overstating what she was going to pay the maid on the work visa that she'd obtained for the maid. And does that mean that she actually pocketed that money?
It's not so much that she pocketed the money as much as that once you make a formal statement in a visa application and do not adhere to it, then ipso facto, you are in violation of the law. It's as simple as that. What she did, how she sequestered that money, really is not the principal concern here. The principal concern here is the discrepancy between the formal statement and the actual behavior. This is bound to land her into legal trouble.
And so you're saying that the furor in India and in the press is largely concentrating on the manner in which she was arrested, although the authorities are insisting that they didn't handcuff her until she got to the court. But apparently she was strip searched, which apparently has really gotten under people's skin. So what are the kind of things that you're reading and seeing in the Indian press before you left?
Well, the National Security Advisor, who is an otherwise very temperate man, used the word barbaric to describe the manner of her arrest, which I think was, was an overstatement, certainly, and didn't help the atmosphere at all. In fact, it, I think, vitiated the atmosphere further. In addition to that, there are certain Indian actions which, in my judgment, are rather petulant to remove the blast barriers from in front of the American embassy, to strip American diplomats of certain privileges which enable them to go into restricted areas of the airport to greet their compatriots coming in, to enable them to swiftly proceed through customs. These have been withdrawn rather abruptly. Furthermore, both the National Security Advisor and other officials refused to meet a visiting congressional delegation. I think the more appropriate response might have been to meet with the congressional delegation and forthrightly state India's concerns. But this refusal to meet with the congressional delegation really smacks of petulant behavior.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, and he has just returned from India. My understanding, Sumit, is that they've, on top of what you've just told us of the measures you've described as petulant in retaliation against the treatment of the Deputy Consul General in New York, that isn't there some talk of, because of this new anti-homosexual law in India, that they might start arresting American diplomats who are gay?
That careless statement was made by a former finance and foreign minister, but he is not part of the government. He's a member of the opposition, and it is quite apparent to me that he is rather shamelessly playing to a gallery. This is much more to do with India's domestic politics than the than an actual threat with any teeth to it. I think it'll serve him well in certain constituencies, given to a degree of bigotry in India, but I don't think it is a particularly meaningful threat, and one that Indian authorities are likely to enforce or carry out in any fashion. It is a pity that someone of his stature and someone who held important positions in a previous government would stoop to such rhetoric.
But isn't there a broader issue going on here between the Indian government and the U.S. State Department? You just mentioned the upcoming elections. Isn't the front runner in these new elections pretty much on the State Department's blacklist?
That is exactly right. Narendra Modi, the front runner of the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is a right of center political party, and who, in the eyes of many, was implicated in the pogrom that took place in his home state of Gujarat in February 2002, have been denied a visa in the past. And it is unclear how the U.S. State Department is likely to react if indeed he assumes the prime ministership following the elections later in 2014. And so obviously a certain segment of Indian opinion sees this as a kind of a preemptive strike against the United States in the unlikely event the U.S. actually once again decides not to grant a sitting prime minister a visa, which would be, you know, would be downright unprecedented in Indo-US relations. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you reserve for squalid dictators, not for a legitimately elected prime minister, regardless of his prior record.
So what happened to the tilt to India under President Bill Clinton? Because I happen to know the former Prime Minister, I.K. Gujral, at the time, and he was, and Clinton were, you know, best of friends. So what happened?
Even more than Clinton, because Clinton really sort of warmed up to India in the waning days of his second administration, though admittedly he sent certain signals, and his visit toward the tail end of his administration was extremely well received, with Parliament giving him a standing ovation. And then, of course, the two Bush administrations significantly built upon and expanded on the Clinton legacy. Obama, when he came into office, paid scant attention to India, but then subsequently underwent a course correction. And in 2010, when he visited India, certainly he made the right gestures, including opening the possibility of American support for an Indian permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council. But subsequent to that, there have been disappointments on both sides, with various expectations of each other being unfulfilled. And so this untoward incident comes at a time when already the Indo-US relationship was somewhat in the doldrums.
So give us a sense then, Sumit Ganguly, of what's happening now in this Indian election with this right of center candidate Modi from the governor of Gujarat, where you mentioned the pogrom. It's a largely Muslim state. Is he a Hindu nationalist?
There's little or no question that the chief minister of Gujarat is a unabashed Hindu nationalist, and there's a very substantial Muslim minority in Gujarat, many of whom remain quite fearful and resentful, and quite understandably so, in the wake of what happened in February 2002, because little or nothing has been done to address the very legitimate grievances of the community, many of whom suffered quite significantly during that pogrom. Whether or not Mr. Modi was directly complicit, the fact remains that he did little or nothing to stop the carnage. So there's at least a kind of tacit complicity. But he has a substantial amount of support amongst other communities and other groups, particularly in India's corporate sector, because he is seen as someone who can make firm, definite decisions, who can quickly push through policies which are market friendly. He's been quite hospitable to investors. Gujarat has seen significant economic growth under his watch. And consequently, he enjoys a certain amount of support in certain segments of India's population.
Well, conversely, it would seem, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, that the Congress Party, that has been, you know, in there forever, like the Pri Party in Mexico and the Liberal Democrats in Japan, that they have sort of run their course. It looks like the Indian people are fed up with them. So you're saying that Modi is seen as one of these sort of modernizers, somebody that's a champion of the emerging tech sector in India? Is that what's happening?
A modernizer, certainly, as far as the economy is concerned, but certainly not a modernizer when it comes to critical questions of secularism and critical questions of social relations amongst diverse communities in India. I think his rhetoric borders if it does not actually embrace bigotry. And so I would hardly consider him to be a modern individual from that standpoint. But certainly from the standpoint of boosting economic growth, of embracing the market, of providing opportunities for big business, most definitely his outlook is much more favorable to those kinds of developments. And Congress, which for a while had embraced the market, is now sort of pursuing rather retrograde policies, and in many ways is resembling a throwback to an earlier era. And not only that, the party has been implicated in a series of scandals in the recent past, which I think has significantly tarnished its image, and quite justifiably so, I might add.
So this sounds like it's going to be rather awkward, isn't it? If Modi is on the State Department blacklist and he can't get a visa to the U.S., and that, as you pointed out, is usually reserved for people like the dictator in Sudan, who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court, or for someone like Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran. That's bad enough. But then the idea that he is a divider, not a uniter, to sort of quote George W. Bush there, that doesn't bode well for India, does it?
No, it does not bode well. And he is indeed a deeply divisive figure. He is someone who provokes a good deal of hostility from certain quarters in the country. And on the other hand, he also enjoys fervent support amongst other segments of the population. And indeed, his election might place the United States and India in a very awkward position in terms of how best to conduct their relations in a civil and normal fashion.
Well, I certainly don't want to condone the strip searching of an Indian diplomat, but on the other hand, it does seem that this overheated indignation that you're talking about that's going on in India looks a tiny bit hypocritical in the light of the constant reports of gang raping and mistreatment of women. So does that strike you as a bit of a hypocrisy?
There's a huge amount of hypocrisy involved here. There is no question about the fact that the strip searching of this diplomat was singularly inept and completely unnecessary. She was not a criminal. She presumably broke the law. But she was not engaged in some utterly illicit activity like drug running, or there was no allegation of involvement in terror or any such, really loathsome activity. And consequently, I think the behavior of the U.S. Marshals leaves a great deal to be desired. That said, the kind of high dudgeon that the Indians have gone into really overlooks and elides over some very serious problems that Indian society is freighted with, not to mention the frequent maltreatment of women on a routine basis, and particularly for women who are in a subordinate position, who are not in positions of authority, who are employed as domestic help. So that's a conversation that Indians need to have amongst themselves and engage in some serious introspection.
Well, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. It's too bad it's a subject that is so grim.
Well, we'll have another discussion, hopefully a more hopeful one. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair of Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London. His books include Fearful Symmetry, India and Pakistan Under the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons, India Since 1980, and his latest book with Paul Kapoor is India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the Washington Post's new owner, who has a $600 million contract with the CIA.